1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, we look back to a precious time when Pat Benatar had the number one selling album in America.
Hi, this is Pat Benatar.
And I'm Neil Giraldo.
And we're in the studio for Precious Time.
You know the old adage that says, things are not always what they seem. No phrase more accurately describes the first few years of Pat Benatar's career. For buried beneath the Cinderella story of Benatar's rise to fame is the tale of a young woman who found herself an unwitting pawn in a marketing scheme designed to capitalize on Benatar's image as a sex symbol. Born of an opera-singing mother, Pat Benatar began studying opera herself at an early age. With aspirations of one day studying at the prestigious Juilliard School of Music, Pat's interests began changing as she approached adulthood. As a result, she spent most of her early 20s actually retraining her soprano voice to sing rock and roll. With the release of her first album in September 1979, In the Heat of the Night, Pat Benatar quickly became rock's leading lady. Within a year and a half of her debut, Pat Benatar had racked up two platinum-selling albums, one of which had gone all the way to number two and stayed there for what seemed like an eternity, as well as a top 10 single and her first of four straight Grammy Awards. With so many good things happening to her in such a short amount of time, I asked Pat Benatar to describe her feelings as she prepared to record that third album, Precious Time.
I don't know. You know, it's always mixed. I mean, it was very euphoric because, you know, it was great to achieve what we achieved. And at the same time, the pressure was incredible to have to do this next record. I mean, it's just something that happens. They can tell you it's going to happen, and you know it's going to happen, and there isn't anything you can do about it. It just happens. External. It's never internal. It's the people on the outside, you know, wanting you to perform. And unfortunately, the thing that happens is once you've had a success, in my view of things now, you know, after all these years, is that once you've had a success, people are so locked in, it's so hard for them to let go, that any deviation from that causes havoc. And I'd have to say over the next 8 years that followed, that was the biggest problem. And of course, that stifles you musically because you're growing and they're not.
Cut it out, trap it, count me out.
comes in but the florist, the gardener, and the maid. You call me on the telephone, you say you feel so alone. Too tired to get dressed and get out. First you're happy, then you're sad. Somehow you always hang up mad. Excuse me if I shout.
Benatar's Precious Time. Pat Benatar and producer husband Neil Giraldo.
Well, Billy Steinberg, he wrote Precious Time. He wrote, he writes with Tom Kelly quite a bit.
Yeah, he wrote Like a Virgin.
Like a Virgin as
True
well.
True Colors.
Mm-hmm. True Colors. They write a lot. In fact, we went on after this record, I think it was Get Nervous, we wrote quite a few songs for that as well. But Billy Steinberg is a great lyricist mm-hmm. and a great songwriter. Tom Kelly as well. They work very well together. Precious Time was a song. He had a demo of songs that he gave us when we did Crimes of Passion. That song. Remember that song I think Linda Ronstadt had? That's what I really liked. That How Do I Make You?
Right.
That song. He wrote that. And he gave us a tape of all the songs that he did. And Precious Time was on there. And we actually recorded Precious Time for the Crimes of Passion record. That song was the only song that we had completed before we even started Precious Time.
Right.
We cut it at the same time of Crimes of Passion.
It fit in good, too. It was thematically right. I mean, I was going through a lot of second thoughts about all the things that had happened, whether I was happy with all this, you know, newfound everything, you know.
The record company was still cultivating her image as a sex symbol, while Pat herself, through her music and her interviews, she seemed to be more of a tough chick, if you know what I mean. In fact, in one conversation with the newspaper reporter just before the album Precious Time came out, Pat Benatar was quoted as saying that if she were treated the same way as some of the women in her songs were treated, she would, and I quote, inflict serious injury on the guy. There would be blood in the streets, end quote. Now, that's such a macho statement coming from a petite, at that time, young lady. I had to ask Pat Benatar if she really said it.
I absolutely said that, and I still absolutely mean it.
I like that. That's really good.
I still mean it today.
Oh, shit.
I mean, I don't like to only sing about songs that make me mad. You got to understand, I was 27 years old. I had a lot of machismo going. You know what I'm saying? I came off a few years of a very bad relationship. I was around a lot of girlfriends who went through hell with, you know, men who were just... You know, you have to understand, I grew up with the women's movement. I was like, you know, I was ready to stretch and flex, and I was happening. So, yeah, I mean, I still would inflict serious injury. Somebody really gave me a lot of crap. Ooh, I'm tough, I know. But I've mellowed, you see. I learned to, you know, put the glove on the fist, you know. That's what I learned. Well, except that I always think I'm big. I think I'm a big person. I do.
Yes, that Napoleon complex. Yeah, right? Is that what you're talking
it's
about?
True. I mean, I think I'm big. Neil can't believe it. He goes, "What are you doing? You think you're like a giant person?" And I always have. But I mean, you know, when you're a little person, when you're pushed around in the playground and you're all kinds of stuff like that, that makes you into something else. You know, that big people don't have to deal with. So, and it seriously had not. It wasn't limited to men. It was people in general. So,
over the years, Pat Benatar also learned how to slow things down and sing ballads. But in 1981, at the time of Precious Time, she was still pretty much sticking to the hard, fast stuff. So I asked Pat and her guitar-playing husband, Neil Giraldo, if that was intentional.
Yeah, no, it wasn't.
It just wasn't a good one. We couldn't just write one. It wasn't intentional.
It just worked out that way. I mean, we had done, I know one of my biggest disappointments ever that I've done was, I know he'll say you're nuts, but was on Crimes of Passion was Wuthering Heights, you know, and it was so hard for me. I was still so young, and the way that I was singing was so new to me, and I wasn't versed yet, and it was just, I wasn't able to go back and forth really easy yet, you know. I still hadn't found a niche for my voice. I was still experimenting all the time, so I wasn't comfortable going between the two. I found it much more comfortable to blast, and that's what I did. I've always been very honest. And that's exactly what it was. I wasn't ready to be vulnerable. I wasn't ready to expose yet, you know? That comes with time. That comes with experience. I wasn't ready.
We'll be right back.
one of two cover songs on the Precious Time album. That's Pat Benatar doing one of my favorite Paul Revere and the Raiders songs, Just Like Me. Up next, we'll find out which came first for Pat Benatar and producer husband Neil Giraldo, their love affair or playing in a band together. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Pat Benatar and Neil Giraldo for the anniversary of the number one selling album, Precious Time.
Hi, I'm Pat Benatar. Welcome back to In the Studio, this week focusing on Precious Time. And now back to Redbeard.
Thanks, Pat. Pretty well known is the fact that Neil Giraldo is also Pat's guitar player, co-writer, band director, and album producer. What isn't as well known is which came first, the love affair between Pat Benatar and Neil Giraldo, or his appointment as the musical director of her band.
No, I think it all was at the same time.
Yeah, it was professional on his part. It was pure lust on mine.
Oh, boy. It all, Redbeard, don't listen to her.
I liked you right away.
It happened all at the same time. You know, in other words, I came in to play some guitar, and to be the musical director of the band, which led to being the producer and all that other stuff, that good stuff that goes with that. At the same time, we was falling in love. So
I just give you a hint. The first time I ever saw him, I was just recently divorced. I mean, by a very short time, and I was looking very forward to being single and famous and all those kinds of things. And he walked in, and I called my very best friend that night, and I said, I met the father of my children. She said, you're out of your mind. So it was a ton of bricks. Well, sometimes you just know. Yes, but that's until you find the right one. Hide your heart from jerks. Okay? Put your guard up for those people. When you got the right one, honey, put it down. Yeah, but they begged us not to get together. You're going to ruin it. You're going to break up the band. They were, like, distraught, but we said tough. Yeah. That was it. I mean, basically it. They just thought that we would, you know, once it wouldn't last, and once it didn't last, not only would our relationship be over, but our musical relationship would be over, and that's what they didn't want to happen.
Never again. Isn't that what you say? You've been through this before, and you swore this time you'd think with your head. No one would ever have you again. And if taken was gone, I'd get done. You decide where and when. Just when you think you've gone down. Your heart's so securely tied and bound. They whisper.
Often ready for love, better
Promises in the Dark from Pat Benatar's album Precious Time.
You know, when we wrote together in those days, it was still so very new, and I was always so embarrassed to give him my lyrics, you know. So we had a little, in the house we were renting, he had a little a room that he had all his equipment set up, and he would go in there and he would write, and I would slip them under the door because I was just too ashamed to, like, show. And he was never allowed to, like, look at them and me at the same time. So, this was a personal song, you know. It was just about a tiff, and it was about questioning where we were going and all that kind of thing. And, you know, and then, of course, it was embellished with other people's situations and things. So, oh, literally slipped them under the door.
Nah, she's lying.
You lie. I did, too. I remember doing it. I was just so embarrassed. I mean, he would think it was...
Well, she would say, you know, I got this idea. I got this. I think it's really good. I go, oh, great. I love to see it.
No,
well,
you
no,
can't.
I can't see it yet.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll wait a little while. Then I'll wait a little while and she'll say, you know, I got this idea. Let me just tell you this. Don't laugh. I'm not laughing. And she'll look at me and I'm not laughing. And she goes, you're laughing. I'm not laughing. If you say it enough times, I'm going to laugh. And she would do that all the time. And she really did.
Especially
that.
When it was a personal situation. It was so hard. I mean, you have to understand our situation, our relationship was not, it wasn't like being able to hold in and cover up your feelings. You were exposing your feelings to the person that you were writing about. It was a very strange thing to do. I mean, you had to, like, you know, bite the bullet and just do it because I knew it was worthwhile to do. But, you know, personally, as his, you know, significant other, it was tough.
So I had to ask Pat if writing those lyrics and sharing them are tough. What is it like singing them in front of 15,000 people night after night on stage?
Well, it's liberating. I mean, you know, at first it's very uncomfortable, but by the time you get to the stage that you're going to sing it in front of everyone, all that's worked out. You know, you've worked it out with yourself, and it's very freeing. It's like going to the shrink, you know what I mean? You go to the shrink in the first few times, it's really impossible to say anything. And then after that, it's like, you know, it's what they say, the truth will set you free. And that's what happens. Everything is on the table. And it's just, to me, it's a positive thing. But that comes only with time and with growth and maturity. I mean, it doesn't happen initially, I don't think, unless you're just wonderful, you know, which I'm sure most of us aren't.
Make it.
Here's Pat and Neil Giraldo in the studio.
Oh, God. How many dates weren't we touring? It was a road show. We were on, you know, I mean, that was when we were doing 12, 14 months at a time, that kind of thing. We were doing it during, in the heat of the night. We did 14 months in a row. It was nuts. But, I mean, you know, that was the old way. That's what you did. There was no MTV. You had to go on the road. You had to expose what you were doing to everybody. And that's how you did it. Very badly, I'm afraid. I look back and I just go, oh, man, that purple zebra. What was I thinking of? Oh, yeah. I see some pretty funny pictures when I look in those books.
Every time she sings, I can't believe it.
He's my biggest fan.
I am. I think she's the greatest singer in the world. I'm telling you. Unbelievable.
Does it just mean I don't have to cook tonight?
No, you're still cooking. No. Don't believe that, Redbeard. I cook outside all the time.
I'm always
barbecuing something.
He just lies.
No, I don't believe her. She's not telling the truth.
He lies.
But I do. Every time she sings, I can't believe it. I look at Frank all the time. I go, whoa, listen to that.
They laugh at me, too, though. No, you don't understand.
Don't laugh.
They do laugh.
Funny.
Ooh, you're giving me the fever tonight. I don't want to give in. I've been playing with fire. You forget I've seen you work before. Take them straight to the top. Leave them crying for more. I've seen you burn them before. Fire and ice. You come on like a flame. Then you turn a cold shoulder. Fire and ice. I wanna give you my love, but you just take a little piece of my heart. You just tear it apart. Moving in for the kill tonight. You got every advantage when they put out the lights. It's not so pretty when it fades away, 'cause it's just an illusion in this passion play.
Gift as a producer to me, not just because he's my husband, but is that he can step away from his preferences and go for the good of the, you know, the project or the person. He knew that that song was really suited to my voice, and even though he wasn't cracked up about it, he didn't love the whole idea of it. Once he heard me sing it, he knew that it was right for me to do. It was the correct thing, and he puts that stuff aside and goes for the, you know, the good of the whole rather than the individualistic thing.
When I asked Neil Giraldo the same question about his thoughts as he listens to those words every night on stage, I got quite a different response.
Okay, I can explain the car. When I if I hear it in the car, I'm listening. Drum track even. It's a drum track even. Dum bum 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 bum. Guitar in tune. Guitar in tune. Bum bum bum. I'm listening to all these things, these arrangement, production, all these things I'm listening to. It's a vocal. Oh, I remember that line. Oh, yeah. Oh, I wish you would have done it better. Oh, that was a good one. And I do that kind of thing. As far as that, thinking about it as being like a love letter or any lyrics, believe me, I would never even really pay any attention to the lyric. I'm looking at it from a different point of view. On stage, it's kind of the same thing. I'm trying to dig into the feeling of the song and trying to capture the groove and feel it and play it. I'm not really, really concerned with what the meaning of the song is, really.
It's different for me. I'm speaking the word, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm listening. I'm feeling the soul, but I'm not paying attention to the literal meaning of the words, so to speak. So it really doesn't affect me.
It's different. Plus, it's a male-female thing without sounding sexist. I mean, it's just different. It's the way that women interpret things and hold on to them and the way that men interpret things. It's not a big deal to them, you know. To us, it is.
Still to come here in the studio, Pat Benatar and Neil Giraldo explain how their relationship and their relationship with their record company all finally came to a head. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Pat Benatar and Neil Giraldo on the anniversary of Pat Benatar's precious time at number one.
Hi, I'm Pat Benatar.
And I'm Neil Giraldo.
Welcome back to In the Studio, and now back to Redbeard.
Thank you both. Precious Time, the album, was released in July 1981. And within a month, it was the number one selling album in the United States. Credit for the album's quick rise to the top should partially go to the popularity of that first great single, Fire and Ice. Here's Pat Benatar with Neil Giraldo in the studio.
Luckily, the audience has always really been receptive to the new songs, always. And we've never had that problem where that new songs die, you know, so I don't know. I can't really say. I mean, usually when we play the new songs, they're very happy to hear them. We would go out simultaneously with the record. The record would just be, you know, going up the charts. You know, this one especially. I think it went platinum in 13 days, and it was so quick that by the time we even got out there, they knew the songs. You know, so I never felt that. You know, that weird kind of lapse that happens sometimes when you have new material. Yeah, but you have to understand, it came off of Crimes of Passion when that sold 5.5 million records. That was at number two for, you know, 3,000 weeks. So the minute this record came out, it just went. I mean, you know, you have to look at what happened in front of it, too. You know, when you're working, when you're on the road, time stops and you're kind of in limbo and, you know, you're just getting bits and pieces of what's going on. You're certainly not reading Billboard every week, and people are only calling you with updates. And so it was very gradual, even though it went quickly. It's still a gradual thing. They're calling you, oh, it's at number, you know, 20. It's at number 10. It's at number 5. I mean, you know, it's moving in a gradual state. I mean, it didn't go from 75 to 1, you know, not like it does today. It's a different thing now. So it was gradual, but, I mean, it was very quick.
They were so ecstatic when the letter arrived. A certified genius at the age of 5. They planned his future so carefully. He was everything they'd hoped he'd be. He was a model child, a devoted son, loved and admired by everyone. He played out every role. Fantasy.
album Precious Time hit the top of the album selling charts the week of August 15th, 1981. At the time, Pat Benatar was on the road with Neil Giraldo and the band. So I asked them how they found out it was number one.
We were on the bus, I remember.
We were on the bus, and
it was on the radio, and they said that it just went to number one.
That's really exciting.
Yeah, so it was great. I don't remember where we were. We were somewhere in the middle of the country, and that's what they said. It came over the radio that Precious Time just went to number one.
Just like when I'm making a record, I was so concerned with the tour, with the set and of new songs we should put in and stuff like that. I was excited, but it's so different when you're on the road and you're doing those kind of tours that we were doing then. Because it really, I mean, I would like to see that happen with the new record, because then I would be able to appreciate it.
That's right.
I didn't appreciate it then because I really didn't have any idea what was going on.
Yeah, we were now so concerned with, like, working. I mean, you know, you were out there every day for so long. I mean, it was, you know, this was great, but, you know, I got a show to do. That was the whole attitude, you know. We were bummed. No, we were screaming. We were, like, berserk, you know, because we had really expected it to happen with Crimes of Passion. I mean, Crimes of Passion held it, too, for so long. And, you know, so we were just so excited that it went, that Precious Time went as quickly as it did.
Even with the number one selling album in the country, Precious Time, and starting to amass up to 4 Grammy Awards by this time, Pat Benatar still had a big question mark with her future about the ultimatum that Pat gave management and the record company.
It was personal growth. I mean, by the time we had gotten to this, we had learned and experienced a lot of things in a very short time. I was re-examining my reasons for doing it, period, and what I intended to do in the next phase. And, you know, what happened was that I had a record company and a management group that refused to be open-minded. And what happened is it was a constant battle with them. I was already gone. By the time this record came out, I was already moving to another place, except that they weren't letting me. And at that time, they still had control. They had contractual control. I didn't have a choice at that time. And that was when I said, you can do anything you want, but you can't make me make records. And if you don't let me make the kinds of records that I want to make, I won't make them anymore. And that was, you know, the beginning of the end of this whole thing.
My wife's got she's got strong intentions. When she says something, she really means it. I mean, she's not one to kind of like twist an idea. She tells you right up front what it is. I don't know. I'm just so glad she's what she is.
She was supportive. I mean, you know, he was right there always. He was right behind me saying, "I'm not scared. You do what you got to do." You know what I mean? And whatever it takes. And he was always supportive. We stood together, allied against the forces of evil. And, you know, sometimes we lost. I mean, they had made our lives hell for a little bit. But, you know, in the end, I truly believe that we were right. Because the most important thing when you're making music is that you must be true to yourself. You have got to make music that you believe in, that you feel, or you might as well do something else.
Yeah, Redbird, you got to understand that when the wife was going through these times in 81... the record company was airbrushing, you know,
my clothes off.
Clothes. They were airbrushing clothes. They were doing everything. We're talking about control from management and the record company that really, she couldn't really do anything. I mean, in other words, we were making records. We were trying to do something. And we were getting told what we're supposed to do,
right?
We can do and what we can't do. And they would play both ends against the middle.
There was no chance going in that I was ever going to do another one of those records. No chance. Not that I don't love him, because, you know, it was great. It was great. We did a lot of good things. We accomplished a lot of stuff, and I was really, you know, musically, a lot of the things worked, and it was fun, you know, part of the time. But, like I said, things have changed, and, I mean, I just had never, there was never an intention of ever going back in to do it again, and whatever the outcome was, whether everybody was happy or I was happy, I wasn't really that concerned.
Just when I needed to be on my own.
This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, Pat Benatar and Neil Giraldo. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2016, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune, theme song Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.